So thank you for coming to the 2017 Jaguar Awards. My name is Brad McKay. I'm the director of the awards. I was thinking beforehand, I'm just going to say a few words. I reflect on the first time I brought my daughter, the second time I brought my daughter to the awards, Clara, who's in the front, she's kind of my personal assistant. And the first time she was here, she was a baby, literally. She was at the Victory Cafe. It was our first awards, and she was kind of crying. And I was emailing Seth back and forth, who co-founded the awards. And I was saying, the February awards were like our baby. It's like a teenager, basically.
And then I responded, yeah.
Pardon?
Which I responded, yeah.
And it's true that you love them, but they're also infuriating. Anyways, I want to say it's really important that everybody's here. It's also really special because it's the 100th anniversary of Doug Wright's birth this year. Doug Wright is who we named the awards after, who's a classic Canadian cartoonist. And to commemorate it, Seth actually has reimagined and redesigned our trophies, which I draw your attention to, for Best Book and Spotlight Award. And these are actually ceramics, right?
Yes.
That you made a model out of. And one is, for the best book, I think it's the older Nipper Trial, and the second one is the younger Nipper Trial. I draw your attention to that. I also want to mention, if you didn't see it in the pre-show slideshow, that we have launched, actually, at 8 a.m. tonight, an online art auction that'll cover the expenses of our nonprofit, like the trophies, and then the hats, and the banners, and everything else in Sprint Care. So there's 13 or 14 pieces of RT-inspired art on eBay. It starts right now. It was just a branded piece. Ars Koryak was sketching over here behind me. Did a piece for us, Jesse Jacobs, Joe Ullman, John Marks, Connor Williamson, and many more. So that is online now. We'll be rolling out pieces every few days. They're up for 10 days. In addition, we're very happy that the Wright family was with us. Donated an original piece of artwork from Deb Wright, to help show your support for the awards, so that'll be going up, so thank you for that. So if you want to find that, you just have to go on eBay and search Deb Wright Awards fundraising auction, or be on Twitter and Facebook as well. I just wanted to say that with Deb Wright, I feel like it's almost like a surrogate dad. In addition to naming the awards after him and then putting so much time and effort into growing them, I've written a book about him. Read everything he's published, I think, twice over. and I feel the same way about the Wright family, I think it's fair to say. They're with us behind us tonight. So we have Phyllis, who is Doug's widow. We have Ken, who is his youngest son, Nipper, actually, in theory. And Kim, which is Ken's, well, I guess, his grandson, sorry, Kim. Right? All right, that's
who we are.
Yes. a round of applause. Things don't always go as planned. Aforementioned, Dave Collier thing. So you stuck with us year to year. I'm thinking of some awards with certain hosts saying certain off-color things. The fact that you have stuck with us is fantastic, and it's honor. It's a genuine honor for you to be up here with you and with Seth. Help present these awards to people, so I want to thank you for that. And before I wrap things up, I just wanted, I think Ken wanted to say a few words. Ken?
On behalf of the real Doug Wright family, thank you for having us. It's a pleasure to be here to recognize emerging Canadian cartoonists. And our families, congratulations. And that's my mother, Phyllis, and my brothers, Bill and Jim. My dad's grandchildren and great-grandchildren who he never saw, we congratulate the winners of tonight's awards. Thanks.
That's the important part about to go through sponsors and thank people. So I want to thank TCAP for hosting us in this venue every year, being supportive, giving us a home. The Beguiling, who sponsored, and Peter Bergamo, who sponsored the jury dinner and did so much more. Grass, we got him. Is here somewhere. He donated beer, which is in the gift bag, which I'll mention in a minute. Quilly Choir Magazine, Tattle Creek, Connie Quarterly, Conundrum Press, and Fama Press. mom's cookie jar, who was a 92-year-old woman in Unionville who helped us make Nipper cookies for our Nipper kids. If you're lucky enough to get one, enjoy it. So those. I also want to thank Joe Ullman in the audience, Sean Rogers, Megan Liang, which I really should thank twice. I think I do actually in here, who's in front. They all serve the nominating committee. Dakota McFadden is in the audience somewhere, Allison Lang and Sue Carter, who all sat on the jury this year, so thanks to them. And I have to mention Bob Sikoriak, who not only made an amazing piece, R. Sikoriak, he not only contributed a piece of art to our Archie Comics auction, which you can see on the screen later, but he humors us every year by live drum the ceremony. Literally, he just heard us talk about 5-6 years ago. We were just talking about this before. I was trying to get all these different cartoonists to do this because he thought it was a cool idea. And all of them were like, I'm not doing that. You're crazy. I saw PG here at TPAP, and he just overheard us. He said, are you looking for something to live draw something? And I'm like, yeah. And who are you? He's like, I don't think it's Bob Sikoriak. And I'm like, but you were in Rum Magazine. And you were nervous. You can't even win one of these. And then he sent an email, I want to let you know, I'd like to buy your award again. What are you going to see? I mean, he's doing this at a business heart, but don't buy this.
I don't know if you've been watching the news lately. it's weird downstairs. It's been over 8 years since Americans talked openly about moving to Canada, but I never stopped. Canada's where I've met maybe most of the best people I know in comics. Not the least of which is Andy Goyan, my publisher and my friend. Sort of another to me and many others, sort of a sister, and is celebrating her 10th anniversary this year. Also, go ahead. Stay in his home and use up all his toilet paper. So thanks a lot, Canada, for letting me come. Getting to meet heroes like Seth, Chester Brown, DeForge, Brad. It's been very good to me. So I'm not only delighted, but I'm proud to be associated with the Doug Wright Awards in any small way, an award that celebrates both the history and the future of Canadian cartooning. And I found very, Phyllis, if you'll forgive me, bitchy online about comics awards and the whys and hows of how they're organized and used in our industry. Heidi McDonald, who's in here somewhere, suggested to me once that it was maybe because I never got nominated for them myself, which I'm still angry at. She was forgetting that I was nominated once for a Harvey Award for Best Letterer. Winning a Harvey for Best Letterer is a little bit like winning the Porn Award for the Best Fluffer. Which I have also never been nominated for. Anyway, I never won the Harvey because I was too proud to do the shilling that it takes to win an online popularity contest. Some awards make you look worse, not better. Number two dad, for instance. Harvey Award nominated letterer. Autobiographical cartoonist. The Wrights aren't like that. There are many things that make the Doug Wright Awards great, but what really sets them apart for me as more than just blurb and press release fodder is their focus on promoting and venerating and preserving comics that challenge. Carve out a space for those cartoonists can find a little sun, a little warmth, and maybe the breathing room to challenge themselves. And the Wright Awards reward work by a dizzyingly diverse group, at least compared with most of my American Comics Awards. They regularly recognize work by women, people of color, members of the LGBTQ community, comics about biblical sex workers by white men. I can't think of another award that supports such challenging approaches to comics. I believe there's no more noble function for art than to challenge both the audience and the artist himself. Beauty is nice, but beauty is not enough. If you want something really good, something lasting and valued, you need an American. An American to host your awards program. At least until you can get Scott Thompson to answer your question. That's what he said. So let's roll right into the awards and see if we can get out by midnight. I'd like to call to the stage now the nominees for the 2017 Doug Wright Awards, beginning with Mr. Chester Brown. Thank you. Matthew Rikers.
Say things?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. It's a really honor for me. And I would like to thank Nathalie Gauthier. This is like not my ex and still something. You know. There's Robert Plain helps me each month. He's like a mecen. So you can see he got the gallery, robertplain.com. And Andy, I would like really to thank Andy because he has balls to print that. And honestly, I was expecting the book to be printed in French really easily, and I have trouble making it in English, and that's the reverse that comes out. Anyways, so have a nice time. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Next up, we have the 2017 Doug Wright.
Oh, Mark Tessier.
Oh, you're right.
I'm going to say something about Doug Young.
I will now ask Mark Tessier to take the nominated committee appreciation of this year's winner. Mark Tessier.
I have two texts. I have the statement, and I wrote something for Doug Young because I think it's worth it. Because he looks like a young kid who just won an award and has been at it for a long time. So when I started doing comics like 30 years ago in Montreal, Ariel Vanion was already at it, an independent creator, still screening his covers, and then all the comic pages and his books. He inspired a whole movement of artists in Montreal like me, Julie Doucet, Simon Bossé, Bill Mavrias, like he. And he's been called the godfather of the Montreal comic scene. So that's very important to remember. So for almost 40 years, been at it. Like, Vallion is amazing. He creates collage, paintings, sculptures, music. He did posters for Fofone Electric, which like are memorable, and comics. So you can consider Vallion an amazing, versatile, contemporary artist. That's very important. He's still an inspiration to me. And I say in his own word, he's the god, he's the one artist. So that's my statement. Okay, now let's talk a bit about the Palace of Champions. Okay, Ariel Vallion pushes comics to the furthest extremes in terms of both words and images. He crams his panels and pages full to bursting with garbage and viscera and bodies in excruciating distress, while also twisting his words almost beyond recognition in a kind of degenerate poetry. A satiric vision of Montreal as hopeless inferno, Palace of Champion is a gorgeously printed objet d'art that provides the full Vallion experience. Immersive, icky, cancerous, rotten, and always very, very funny. And I would add, very beautiful. So congratulations to Ariel Vallion on winning this year's Pigskin Peters Award. Well,
I would now like to invite Steve Minnelli up to the stage to say a few words about a very special person. And
thank you. I feel fairly qualified to tell you things that the public might not be able to find online about her, or know about Amy, or isn't obvious at first to meeting Amy, but I am. Anybody who meets Amy agrees that she's warm and insanely generous. But I'd like to focus on some of her weirder qualities. Like for one, she swears like a sailor. That's my first slide here. First swearing. So that should have been the 10th anniversary logo. We can go straight to the next slide. I don't know how many of you guys follow Annie on Instagram, but this is a common post when she's meeting an artist for lunch. And I don't know if you can read what it says at the bottom there, but it says, waiting on Matt Forsythe, which, and she does this for every artist, waiting on Neil Collin, waiting on Michael DeForge. And next slide. I think that is incredibly, incredibly rude. Because I'm waiting, and she arrives 15 to 20 minutes early to every meeting because she loves flexing her superior time management skills on artists. Which is rude. I know. And Amy, another thing about Amy that you all might not know is that she has terrible taste. Next slide. She has horrible taste in movies. And I think if you check this out, this speaks for itself. This one, that I looked this one up today, that was at 5.1 on IMDb, which is the worst rating a movie can get in my estimation, because a 10 is a great film. And a 1 can be pretty entertaining sometimes. But a 5 is nothing. It's nothing. And I went to see this one and she loved it. It's just terrible. By the way, this is directed by Kenneth Branagh. So Kenneth Branagh. So it seems like in some ways Annie isn't as discriminating as you guys all think. And yet, like you go to the next slide. She's so inattentive. It's like OCD level sometimes. It's crazy. You can ask her husband, Scott, or her printer about this. I don't know if you can see that, but that's very close to true. So being the complex character she is, Amy is a type of these specific things. And yet there's other things, like in the next slide you'll see, she's a little too easygoing about some of these things. It's like, I can't even understand some of these decisions. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, I mean, sure, like, yeah, let's put that next before. I don't know if you like the names, it's like those swearing things, kind of like a kind of a rude name, and you make kind of rude things. I don't even know, yeah, she's rude things. Do you go to the next slide? So Annie never plays exactly by the rules, which makes her great at smuggling stuff. So if you go to a movie, or go to any kind of event, there's always a backpack filled with candy and chips and stuff. She can bypass it right past the vendor sometimes. And this is actually a true one, because she'll always have a backpack full of like little chocolates and things, and we'll sit down in the movie and she'll be like, oh, here's some chocolates, and she'll pass them into the whole row. How many chocolates did you bring? And that's extra weird. This is an extra weird quality, because this is like, that's like Superman carrying like a backpack or a kryptonite around, because Amy's allergic to chocolate. That's just weird, man. So you go to the next one. And I don't think people who immediately notice, people who got to talk to her a little bit longer know that Amy is insanely funny. But I was going to take some quotes. I was like, oh, some funny quotes. And then I thought, yeah, because of her love of swearing and really rude comments, I can't even say any of them here, so we'll just skip that one, go to the next one. So, if I can earn this for just a second here, I want to point out that this isn't just a comment on fighting through physical illness, and it's mostly a comment on the incredible bull that Annie has to deal with. Because comics is sort of, it's a white dude's thing for so many years, and it's like, that's an extra layer of, I had to write anything for this one, so I'm struggling with this one, but I know what I mean. It's just been an old boys club, and to break into that and break through it is an extra hurdle that she's pushed through, and amazingly, and made her mark despite that. And that is very amazing to me. And you can go to the next one. So that's basically the gist of what I wanted to say, but I'd love everybody to give Annie a warm round of applause.
While she still manages to maintain a clinical focus.
Gigi's stories capture the sensations of longing and romantic loss without ever being self-pitying, perhaps because her drawing is so observant, objective, and carefully calibrated. And Nathan Jurevicius for Birthmark. His latest picture book slash graphic novel. The fertile imagination of Nathan Jurevicius gives birth to all manner of bulbous, squishy critters, and visionary landscapes, building an occasionally malicious but always resplendent world of oppression and barbarous food chains. Jurevicius conjures the story of a boy and his grub worm with glowing pastels and bone-deep desperation. Laura Kennens for Alien Beings. Weaving divorce, aliens, and adolescent confusion, Alien Beings by Laura Kennens offers readers a glimpse into the life of a young girl growing up in the 90s. Simple pencil crayon drawings complement the short but poignant story and takes us on a nostalgic trip through our own childhoods. Brie Moreno for Dearest Gift Shop 3D and Misty. Combining glamorous fashion, domestic life, and the toys and trifles of childhood into a dreamy, otherworldly vision, Brie Moreno's comic can be equal parts. Steve Lopar.
Like to do right now? And with some
later.
I mark this line out in the script here, I'll just, you know what, I'll just throw this page away, no problem. Instead, now I'd like to welcome Mr. Conan Tobias, the editor and publisher of Tattle Creek, and senior editor of Quill and Quire, to the stage to help induct our 2017 inductee, the Giants of the North.
Feel to them underneath. They don't look like any Disney character in particular, but they sort of look like they have Neil especially, as I told you, that in Neil's heyday, readers would often comment, say, they don't all remember, recall Neil from during childhood, even a fake character. Of course, it wasn't possible because he didn't do this. But I did certainly have that stuff. Neil started as a newspaper comic in the series of Canadian Weeklies. The early strips had kind of an adventure feel to them, kind of like Floyd Gothard's and Mickey Mouse adventure strip. The later strips became more and more surreal, and Catherine Offord says that they more symbolized a comic rather than actually being a comic because they just were so strange. During the time Arne was doing the Middle Horse comic strip, he was contributing to Morning Size, CBC's old National Morning Show, talking with Don Aaron on a regular basis, the host, about comics, about old comics, newspaper comics. He parlayed that into some other work, did a five-part documentary, looking at history of comics, but also the importance of comics, which is something that wasn't considered a lot back then. And he also parlayed that into something else that was interesting. One year, Morningside had so much money in the budget that I needed to spend before the end of the year, and so Arne said, oh, hey, I've got this obscure newspaper character, one that write a musical comedy for CBC Radio, and he typed up a script and five original songs, and I loved it, and it ran on CBC Radio. So we need to add the Innocence Wife Impresario, I think. It's definitely important title for Catherine, because I was looking at sort of brand identity and brand expansion long before anybody else. And I'll also mention that Arne also voiced Neil DeVore's the radio poet and sang as well. 1982, Dave Sim and Jenny Wilbert were looking to expand their press repertoire behind beyond Dave's Serialist comic. And Dave had seen the Neil strip and asked Arne if he was interested in doing a comic book. Arne hadn't set out to make comic books, even if he didn't do a newspaper strip, but it was Neil DeVore's comics and stories where the idea of Neil DeVore and his friends really gelled. And the creation was perfected. The format was unusual. It was less like a comic book and more like the old British children's annuals that I loved, that were there and that sort of thing. It contained a lot of comic stories. It contained reprints of the old newspaper strip. It contained text pieces. It contained head-up paper dolls with fashions for Coupe. And it contained letters page to Arne writing character as Neil and Sophie and Coupe. And most unusually, it contained sheet music of songs that Arne wrote as sort of a soundtrack to the new Neil stories in the issues. Having music in the comic was unusual enough, but it also had dancing in the comic. The characters were dancing to pages and pages. There was a special two-issue tribute to Fred Astaire, where Arne just choreographed an entire day sequence of Astaire and Coupe, and Wallace people pointed out that he did not just draw people dancing randomly. Skirt had a choreograph. She had done some dancing in her youth, and she actually hooked up something called a thermal printer to a VCR and printed out stills of Astaire dancing from the movies frame by frame and pinned them all up and did a proper dance sequence to the comics, which is also pretty unusual. Neil moved over to Renegade Press when Dave and Dory split up and split the company's assets. Sold pretty well, but the 80s were sort of a weird time for black and white independent comics, and the series ended after 15 issues. Plans for a Neil stage play and a graphic novel and a Neil animated Saturday morning cartoon kind of fell flat and became sort of disillusioned with the industry. But at the same time, they could also sort of figured out that why he had been happy he was gone in all these years and started transitioning into Catherine. Even though it wasn't planned, Arne and Neil sort of vanished from the public at the same time. I asked Catherine a while ago why these characters, why of course sort of cast these strange wooden doll, why she chose those characters to tell her story, and she said just because those were the characters that came to me. And I also asked her about and offered me a comment that Neil was a gay comic or a feminine comic. She didn't see that at all either. It wasn't meant to be gay or female or male or straight or kids or for adults. There's simply the stories that she wanted to tell. She told me the way she wanted to tell them. But she also mentioned that it wasn't until after her transition that she realized how much these three characters were each a different part of her. personality, you know, sort of a childlike side. And I'm on time for this year, and I can attest to very childlike in the best place possible. Very happy and laughs a lot, and every time she's not talking, she's singing and humming, and she gets a lot of joy out of things. I think people have, don't remember having a joy out of. She told me that Sophie was her straightforward business-like side. She told me a lot of stories, she asked me not to repeat, but also attest that excellent business person, and has very good business skills, that's all I'll say about that. And she told me that Poupe was her, or in particular, Arne's feminine side, side that he didn't quite know what to do with or how to bring out yet. And the reason that Poupe was always looking for romance and love and for a partner was he couldn't find it was because Arne also was looking for those things as well. And thankfully, was able to find them for transition to Catherine. Catherine's had a really interesting life of ups and downs in the years since. She's got a really unique mind and a unique talent, and she's extremely interesting and extremely funny. And I don't think comics have seen the likes of Neil Horst's friends again since. As someone who read Neil in his glory days, I'm really happy to see her slowly returning to the spotlight over the last 2 years through her induction to the Judge Schuster Awards Hall of Fame. Through the collector edition of Neil Horst, the commander is releasing this weekend, first time Neil has seen her in almost 30 years. And of course, most importantly, for this honor tonight. Catherine spent a lot of years disillusioned with the industry, but I know she's really excited to start drawing again and making the world safe for musical comedy once more. And I'm certainly looking forward to seeing what she does next and what's next for Neil. So please welcome to the stage Catherine Collins.
Definitely is. Maybe that's it.
But anyway, nobody can do a whole lot of work for a whole lot of years all by themselves. And so if David ever gets this message, I hope he hears it somehow, that I'm thanking him for his immense collaboration with me. So, when I knew that I was going to have to give something resembling a speech, I asked several people, how long should it be? Should it be 2 minutes, or should it be half an hour, or should it be 3.5 hours? So that's what I said. Actually, I do have some few topics to cover, so this will be longer than anybody else's speech today. So let me see what I'm talking about. Well, I do also need to mention there's artists in the city in this room tonight who've done an awful lot more than I ever have. You know, as Conan said, after 1993, I didn't do any more comics. But I didn't do anything at all. I just sat around sulking. And so there's people here who've done way more than I have. And really, I think of this award as an award for what might have been. Because what happened was in 1993, suddenly all bets were off for Neil the Horse. The stage play was canceled in a very dramatic way by the producer, the would-be producer. And the animation plans that I had were rejected by all the animation studios in the world. And I couldn't get published. I was working on a graphic novel. And nobody would even talk to me. And it just so happened that a couple of months before this was all going on, that was when I announced my so-called transition, which means transsexualism. Now, I can't say that that's why nobody would speak to me or publish me, but it might have been. Or it might have been that, as I thought for many years, that I'm just a terrible cartoonist, and no wonder they didn't want to publish me. And also, maybe more reasonably, that my work was just so far out of the mainstream, so far out of anything that anybody had ever seen before, that there's really no place to put it and no way to sell it. Which is probably the most likely argument. But I prefer to be insulted and think that I'm boycotted because of being a transsexual. But I wonder whether I am the first transsexual cartoonist to ever win an award. I might be. So on behalf of all my fellow transsexuals out there who get all sorts of terrible treatment, still do. Transsexuals are murdered at a higher rate than anybody else. And so I just want to sort of point out to the LGBT community, in particular the transsexuals, that we deserve to just be put up there with everybody else and not put into some weird category. Except, of course, cartooning is a weird category.
Comment on the media work, because
Travakai and Conan and others keep talking about it. It's not something I ever thought about afterwards, and I didn't think anybody would even remember. I mean, when you do radio programs, they go up into the air and never to be seen again. Although I do have some tapes or something. I just, you know, I would have thought of that as fun. But now everybody's saying, well, you know, it's one of the first people to start talking about comics as an art form, capital A, capital F, that should be appreciated. And I guess that's true. I guess that didn't work very common. Because I must say, whenever I did try to address that subject, I really faced a tremendous headwind. It was really difficult to get anybody to talk about comics without sort of snickering and turning up their nose and making derogatory comments. And the more serious about it I became, the more abusive other people became. It was very difficult in the 70s and 80s to be someone trying to proselytize for comics as a genuine art form. Not that you be taken seriously, necessarily, because that word could pronounce being sober, and that's not what I understand you mean. The cartoons are so often funny and crazy. But, you know, to be judged alongside all the other art forms. And now it's happening. I never expected it. I did it in an atmosphere of complete indifference and scorn and abuse. I was sort of called down mightily by this very snotty woman artist whose name I don't know. She spent a whole radio program being really rude to me and not even letting me speak very much. So here I just never thought that we would see what we now see. All of us here in this room know that in the last 10 years or a little more, there's been this enormous change. And now comics are reviewed alongside other books and other art forms, you know, in the most serious journals. Such as, of course, the New York Times and all those other, you know, Tony magazines, the New Yorker magazine. And so I never expected that. And I don't say that I did it. I don't think my proselytizing really had any effect at all, except maybe on a few listeners like Brad and a few other people. So, you know, if I had any effect, I'm very glad. But I think I was just a very small voice, and maybe it gave some people some ideas to continue to proselytize after my time. But I never expected what we see today is exactly what I wanted, which is comics being published all over the place and being sold all over the place and reviewed all over the place, and in expensive editions and beautiful editions and phone books. And I'm very pleased. I don't take credit for it, but I'm very, very pleased. And I'm living to see the day when people aren't going to be rude and dismissive of comics anymore. And so now I've got my revenge. So now, once I felt that I wasn't going to be published anymore, for whatever reason, I was just staggered by this development in my life. I was about 45 years old at that point. And so in other words, I still had a lot of life left in front of me. But it soon became apparent that I was not going to be a cartoonist anymore because nobody wanted my work at all. And as I said before, I've never really known why, probably. So I had to go on to other things. And I tried very hard to have a life, as is known to happen for some people, they have lives. I never had a life. Before transition, I didn't have a life, I just had cartoons. And then after transition, I was very fortunate. I met a wonderful farmer, the late Bobby Medley, who's my lesbian husband. And I wish she were here with me tonight. But that got me through a lot of years to have a partner. I never have been able to have a partner before. Being transgender is really... It's not really an opportunity for anything much. It's kind of horrible. So that got me through, and then Bobby died, and I didn't know what to do for a long time. My whole sob story is here in the back of the phone book, so you can read it if you wish. And then I went into being a social worker, working with people with what's the fancy term? Intellectual. It's what we used to call retarded. And but I also work with people with autism and conditions like bipolar disorder and stuff like that. All just to, not in any really skilled, trained way, although I did take a few courses, but just to help them with their lives. I sort of became a big sister. And one of the women I'm still in touch with calls me her substitute mother, which is great. And so that's what I did for most of the 2000s. And I just retired from that last year. Largely because of my health, I would have kept going otherwise. So I was just doing completely other different things. And it's kind of interesting, because I didn't tell people I'd been a cartoonist or what that meant to them. You know? And so I was just another, you know, sort of worker with disabled people. And friend and helper to people with disabilities. Completely different life, completely different world, different aim in life. And I was really glad to do it. And I really enjoyed it. And it was great to have some other life besides being a cartoonist. And then, in 2013, I started getting emails. I think they were from Brad, although I'm not sure. I don't remember now. But I knew it was something to do with comics. And I put away comics. I put all my comic collection in storage and dismantled my studio. And to this day, I have not yet drawn the line since 1993. And so I started getting these emails. I see it was something to do about comics, but I didn't even want to know. I didn't read them. I certainly didn't answer them. And finally, who was it? I think it was Robin McConnell said to me, hey, look. You better read and answer these emails because they're trying to give you an award. I didn't know what they were trying to do, but I thought, oh, that's weird. And so I read it, oh yeah, my God, they really did want to give me an award. So I decided to be really gracious and accept it. And they were so grateful. that put me in touch with various comics fans and comics people. Here, I was in Vancouver at that time, that's where I've been now. And so back east here, as we call it, there were people who remembered me. I had thought that I was completely forgotten, that I never had any indication otherwise. I thought I was just a blip on the radar and would, you know, never be remembered for anything. I was getting to accept that. So suddenly, there were all these people who wanted to commemorate me, or that's not quite the word, it used to be dead for that. They wanted to talk to me and tell us things about me, and Conan invited me to contribute to his magazine, which I haven't done yet. I've never been very good on deadlines. That's only 4 years, so it's going to happen. So when all this went down, I was just flabbergasted that I, you know, seemed to be maybe developing a chance for a career. And so then Andy Brown said he would like to publish a collected works, which we started to plan, and then I got really sick. And I was really sick for a year, in bed sick for a year, with an undiagnosed illness. And then I got better, but not better enough. I continued right through, that was in 2015, and in 2016, we started work on the book. But I was intermittently down to the count. And so it took a long time. And that's why Andy's more involved in that. He prefers hair. But we did it. And as I said, for some reason I find this funny. That just about 2 months ago, when we were just trying to finish the book, I got really sick. I ended up back in the hospital and was told later that I nearly died. And I was told that I was very, very lucky to be alive. And I told the doctors, well, that's a matter of opinion. But being alive has never seemed to me to be the best deal. It's so much work, so much trouble. I get really tired of it sometimes. But so all this, you know, sort of changed my life again, put me back into the game. And so I'm going to, as I said before, I'm going to start trying to comics. I've got tons of stories that I had in mind before, 25 years ago, plus all the ones I thought of in the meantime. That's one part of my cartoon brain that kept going in all those years was to keep on thinking of stories, keep on thinking of jokes. I wanted to not lose my ability in case it would happen that I would come back. Not believing that I ever would, but I did. And so that's what I planned. I just hope my health holds up. And as you can see, I can walk and talk today. And it's not always the case. But I'm really going to do my best to stay healthy and to produce good things. And I'm just so grateful for the opportunity again. But in closing, you'll be very glad to know about this talk. I'm a very, very avid historian of comics and collector of comics, and in particular, old comics. My very favorite comics are the old newspaper strips from the late 1890s and on through to about 1960. The big Sunday pages and big daily strips and the continuity stories and I still collect those, as much as I can get a hold of. It's very expensive, but it's a great hobby. And so I'm very aware of so many wonderful cartoonists, men and women. I've got to say, there's at least some more women than we commonly like to believe were producing very good comics back way, way long time ago. And so even if I do get a chance to turn out another 10 or 15 years worth of work, and even if it's good, I'll still be just a footnote to these great, great, great cartoonists and to the great cartoonists, some of whom are in this room today. And so I don't hold myself up to be that great, but I'm very happy to be amongst the cartoon world and the cartoon community and the cartoon artistic tradition. Well, I should add, yes, it's true, my mother was a cartoonist, and her grandmother, my great-grandmother, was a public cartoonist way back around 1900 in Manitoba. Her last name was Collins. Dolly Collins was how she was known. So when I had to change my name as a transition, I actually changed my last name too, which most people don't do. And I took Collins because I wanted to draw a line between my great-grandmother and my mother and me, all cartoonists, all female cartoonists. And now I have a niece who's 22 years old, who's also a cartoonist. But poor woman, she's also a journalist. She's working right now at the Globe and Mail as an intern. She's 22. But she's a very good cartoonist. And I've arranged already for her to inherit my enormous collection of comics and books and so there's another little tradition that I'm part of, which is my own family tradition, the Collins women. So I guess that's what all I should be allowed to say. And I just want to thank everybody again who's responsible for my having this, and everybody who's being so generous and applauding me and appreciating the fact that I'm happy about this. So please, people, read comics. That's what I mean.
Thank you. think there are so many adjectives from John Dev for her personal brand of genius. She was magnetic, she was turbulent, warm, open, gifted, incisive, incredibly generous. She shared, she cared, she made things for you, for her, for everyone. Her work was spoken of by other artists, probably some of you in this room, in this hushed tone, as if they couldn't quite believe what she had produced. Next slide. Next slide, please. From when she first started making zines as a teenager, her comics gutted people with their weird and exquisite vision of the world, with their fragile, powerful, and true line work. She was a poet, a musician, and a cartoonist, and there's a special place in my heart for each of the pieces of her work that I've encountered. Next slide. Whatever medium she used at whatever age, Jean-Pierre's work came out fully formed. It had a universe and a perspective and a fierce beauty all its own. Her work with Bois de Chavannes, her record series, her music, her contributions to the DDQ anthology and the anniversary book, I could spend paragraphs on Werewolf or this piece, which is called Like It's Her Sleeping. They're pieces that cut to the heart of an experience of depression, of dreaming, of not knowing, of loving. What's that? Working on Susceptible with her, which was her gorgeous, delicate, powerful, and expressive, and perfectly edited book. A book that she translated herself, no big deal. I read and reread that book. I got to know Jean-Pierre as the readers did, but also as the kind of confidant that a publisher can be on a memoir. As some of you probably know, Jean-Pierre was a writer of very long emails. She was a haver of long conversations. Next slide. So with this book, I got to see how, from those long conversations, from those big experiences, she trimmed back, how she worried about the impact of her work, how she tried to balance it all out with a sense of the important things in the world. It was part of what made her the kind of artist she was, someone who never settled, who always gave it all. Over the past few years, we also became friends beyond comics. And I can see how she brought that relentless depth and intensity and generosity and thoughtfulness to her friendships too. Next slide. This is a photo of June Say, Jean-Pierre Pestre, and Deanna Ronson in Montreal at her book launch for Susceptible. With Phil, her husband, she built a world and community around her where creativity and kindness and goodness were all of the utmost importance. When I came to visit Anne Cordes, where she lived, for the first time several years ago, she dropped everything to have me over. For dinner, she made a big dinner, and then afterwards she wandered around her house, she showed me her beautiful house, and she looked anxiously for gifts that she could give me. I came away with little experiments of ceramic, sleeping, being people, and her most recent record, and just a knowledge of the warmth that was there. Next slide. The next time that I visited, Jean-Pierre was pregnant, and she was charting to me all the peculiarities of a body in transition, with the intelligence and vibrance and humor that characterized any conversation with her. Finding out she was sick, it felt like being punched in the stomach repeatedly. Every time I think about it, it felt like every cliche about her, like, when she was over a year into treatment for the cancer that killed her, she made a funny, pointy scene for her friends. She wrote a note into it, apologizing to me for sending it too late for my birthday. That was from you. She was always giving, always sharing, always taking something for everyone that would last, and that you would see, and that you would recognize the beauty of it. And it was such a positive scene. The last time that I visited Toronto, I stopped by the gallery, and I picked up a scene by someone whose work I had never read. I finished it, and I realized it was dedicated to Jean-Pierre's memory. Half a year after her death, Just thinking about her makes me tears. And her hoping that she can get to have more time with her daughter, more books, more albums, more experiences. But I am grateful that the work that she did produce has reached people who needed it, and will continue to do so. So with that in mind, I'm going to get off the stage, and I wanted to share a few more of my favorite images and comments from Jamila's work. And thank you, Jamila.
As you imagine. And Mary wept over the feet of Jesus,
Brown revisits and reinterprets familiar Bible stories in his austere and logical style. He unpacks an elaborate theory about a credit genealogy for Jesus Christ. You might not agree with him, but it's impossible to ignore the forceful clarity of Brown's cartooning, which renders everything from the story of Cain and Abel to the parable of the talents crisp and newly alive. Big Kids by Michael LaForge. Colors and images that sear themselves into the mind's eye. In Big Kids, Michael LaForge tackles the typical coming-of-age story in lurid, atypical style, whose listless teenage protagonist discovers that truly mature humans do not become adults, but rather insectoid-like creatures gifted with second sight. LaForge creates a rich and shifting allegory drawn to startling visual invention. Bert's Way Home by Mr. John Martz. Young, cheerful, and irrepressible, the protagonist in John Munson's Birth is eager to share stories about his parents traveling in space. It soon becomes clear, thanks to Mark's deceptively simple cartooning, that Bert is just processing the trauma of losing his parents in his own invented way. In Bert, Mark pulls off a tricky balancing act, using his character's story, grown-up sadness, and somehow still keeping things childlike. The Envelope Manufacturer by Chris Oliveris. In his ode to an analog and increasingly archaic industry, longtime comic publisher Chris Oliveris is keenly aware of the precarious nature of running a small business. In this case, the mundane trade of making envelopes. A masterful cartoonist, his slightly wavering mind lingers over the odd details of mid-century objects, now obsolete, almost alien, as strange and inscrutable as a struggling physical character. And lastly, Bird in a Cage by Rebecca Roy. A loving tribute to the late grandmother who suffered from dementia, Rebecca Roy's Bird in a Cage alternates between humor and sadness. A biographical work that explores a rich personal history and the pains of losing someone you love. Roar's almost effortless use of simple pencil drawing contains a great depth of emotion that resonates with the reader long after finishing the book. And when 2017 Dugwright Award for Best Book is Bird in a Cage. Ah!
Many centered around summers at their cottage.
Rendered in Rohrer's gently evocative drawings, this is a book about the familiar and unwieldy geographies of families and the attendant bumps, craters, and revelations that mark each road. Throughout this, Rohrer manages to be beautifully candid and sensitive without ever becoming maudlin. Bird in a Cage is a stunning debut work, and the nominating committee is built toward a best.